Accession number 8234, reel number 2.
Colonel Draffen, reel 2. I think you were telling me about the headquarter company.
Yes, they were the largest company because they had a transport section and the quartermasters and all the organisation, transport, etc. And then they eventually got the carrier platoon and the mortar platoon. And at the very beginning, of course, they had machine guns, but the machine guns were taken away from us and sent to the 3rd Battalion, who became a machine gun battalion.
You mentioned the transport section. What transport did you have?
Well, at the very beginning of the war, we had extremely little transport, and the government requisitioned lorries from the traders, the Asian traders, the African traders, and in a few from European organisations. These lorries were in the most ghastly state. I mean, it wasn't unknown for a lorry to arrive with no bonnet, for instance. So the section, the transport section, really had a very tough time during the whole of the Abyssinian campaign, because we got up to establishment with lorries, and these saw us through until we got back into Kenya at a place called Kitale after the Abyssinian campaign, and we only lost one of them. I might say that the transport people were more than magnificent, because you'd find a Chev lorry with a Ford carburetor, which we were reprimanded about when we got back to Kitale. They said this was quite unethical, but we thought it was rather good, actually.
But they did manage to keep things going.
They kept them going. It was absolutely magnificent. I wouldn't say that it was always easy, but you'd find the transport section, if they saw a derelict lorry on the side of the road, it was vandalised for spares.
How many men were there in the transport section?
Do you know? I don't know. I've forgotten now. Transport officer, 2 transport sergeants, and I really don't know how many men. But, of course, all the drivers and all the mechanics. So it was quite a considerable force, 60 or 70 men, I should say.
And were they trained mechanics?
No, they were semi-trained, and there again, our transport officer with his sergeants, European sergeants, trained the Africans magnificently. So much so that the Africans themselves were capable of decarbonising a vehicle and reassembling it properly.
So they were learning on the job?
They learnt on the job. They were extremely good.
What about the quartermaster? What did he have under his control?
Well, as quartermaster, he only had a quartermaster sergeant, and I honestly forget the establishment, but not more than 10 or 15 men, because everything was issued down to the companies.
Down to CQMS?
Yeah, down to CQMS in each company.
Now, you mentioned the carrier platoon. When did the carriers arrive?
We didn't get carriers until Madagascar.
So not at all in Abyssinia?
No. The carriers that we had really were taken away to form a recce unit and they mounted machine guns on them, but they were virtually just trucks. They were built by the East African Railways as an armoured truck, but we didn't get a proper carrier with its tracks instead of wheels until after the Abyssinian campaign.
And the mortars, presumably these were 3-inch mortars.
Yes, they were the 3-inch, and they were tremendous. The mortar platoon, which was again headquarter company in Abyssinia, run by a very great friend of mine who was one of the 16 reserve officers, Jabby Trent, and they were very, very accurate. Once you got the feel of a mortar, they were tremendous.
What sort of signals did you have?
Well, we had wireless sets, the number 18, for battalion use, and we used a tremendous amount of telephone with the resultant cable. The wireless sets rarely in Abyssinia and in Madagascar were pretty poor, rarely. We always found that there was a hill in the way, or the forest was too thick, and we had a lot of trouble. But the signal section, again under headquarter company, were really tremendous. For instance, in Burma, our first big attack on point 3069, the signal section laid over 6 miles of wire just for that one operation. And we even found in Burma that division was connected to brigade by telephone, as it being much better. The Burma campaign, the signals had a lot of trouble there because of the fact that you got into this dense jungle with terrific valleys and riverbeds, and you got cut off. You lost your wireless communication very quickly.
What was the sort of maximum range of which the radios were reliable?
Well, if you were in the NFD and you could you had a good vision without any hills in the way, you'd probably get up to 25 miles. But if you were down in a valley and you might not get to your next door neighbour 2 miles away.
How was battalion in contact with company level?
Always by telephone and wireless. And of course, we still had the runner. Not with a cleft stick, but just as good.
What about other means, such as semaphore and hand lamp and helio?
We, as a battalion, were never trained in that. They tried to train them, but there wasn't time, and nor was the equipment available. The gunners from the Indian Mountain Battery, for instance, they had helio and were very successful with it. But as a battalion, we didn't have it.
I'd like to get on now to what you're actually doing in an operational sense. During the defensive phase, before the advance, where were you located?
Well, we started off with our headquarters at Nanuki, and we had a company at Moyale and a company at Wajir, and they were controlling the NFD. Well, of course, two companies on that vast area, the Italians could have walked in straight away, and nobody would have known where they were until they got into the highlands of Kenya. But fortunately, they took rather long time to make up their minds, so that eventuality never came to fruition.
What was your actual post when you were when this defensive phase was occurring? What were you doing within the regiment?
Me personally, at the very beginning of the war, I was intelligence officer. Then After the first week, I was made assistant adjutant because there was so much work to do on the adjutant's department. And I remained assistant adjutant until we went up to the NFD. Then I was made IO again, but just before we moved into operations against the Italians, I was made adjutant. And I remained adjutant until we left Madagascar, when I took over a rifle company. And actually, my first training in jungle warfare was in command of A company in Madagascar. But then we came back to Kenya, and I was appointed second in command, so went over to Burma as second in command.
When the two companies were deployed forward at Moyale and Wajir, presumably the other two companies were back, were they?
Yes, as a reserve, and they changed over each month. We only left the companies up there for a month.
Was there a plan to deal with an Italian incursion if it occurred?
Yes, a terribly simple plan, because having so few troops, all we had got to do was to pass back any information of Italian troop movements as quickly as possible and to withdraw in front of the enemy, trying to establish his roots and his strength.
So
but we were certainly told to withdraw. We couldn't possibly do anything against a force of any nature.
So you'd have been used for observation?
Observation. And, for instance, we established a few miles from Wajir a little airstrip. So we had to have a platoon looking after the airstrip.
What were these two forward companies doing while they were up at Moyale and Wajir? Were they just sitting there in defensive positions?
Moyale was a complete defensive position, and they dug new trenches and really put themselves into a strong defensive position. And they were contained within their fort. But they, during the daytime and at night, they did patrol the frontier to see if they could spot any Italian troop movements.
What sort of strength would these patrols be?
Oh, they were usually quite small, up to six men, a section.
And how far would they go in a day's patrolling? How far?
Well, if they were marching, they would probably go 10 miles out and 10 miles back. But you would send them off in a truck, and they could skirt around and get perhaps 50 or 60 miles away from their base and then do a patrol from there. For instance, we did, in actual fact, from Moyale, go right over to a place called Ndolo. And on to the Somali border and the Abyssinian border. And then, of course, we worked westwards as far as Lake Rudolph. But you had to have your lorry to transport the troops, and there weren't many roads, and it just meant cutting through the bush.
What about the troops at Wajir? Were they also in a self-contained
position? They were in a
position,
a real fort. Beaugest Fort, which was painted white, mm-hmm. completely Beaugest, and they really just did extensive field training, but were there as a backup for Moyale.
Did the patrols forward from Moyale ever encounter any enemy?
No, not during the early time, though. You see, the extraordinary thing was that at Moyale we had our company, and the Italians had a company sitting within 100 yards of us, just looking at us. And that was a terrific battle when we evacuated Moyale. And they got on terribly well. I mean, you used to go and have dinner with your Italian counterpart, even until the war was actually declared. They got on terribly well. The Italians were very sorry that they were done out of their dinner parties.
What sort of Italian troops were they? Were they Europeans?
Oh, they were local Abyssinian tribesmen, the same as we used our local tribes, with Italian officers and NCOs, based very similar to ourselves.
And what were their positions at Moyale like?
It was just trenches with, I presume, wireless communication with their headquarters.
And were their trenches built on the same sort of principles as ours?
They had no weapons that we didn't have. They only seemed to have rifles and the odd machine gun. They didn't have mortars or guns of any sort. But they did their patrolling and we did ours. And it was an information unit, really.
What was the state of intelligence within the battalion when you were intelligence officer?
I think really remarkably poor, because, you see, what did we want? We wanted information about Abyssinia. Well, the only way we could get it was through our patrols from Moyale, by sending out special units, which we did, from Wajir and Moyale, and by air reconnaissance. Well, there was remarkably few air airplanes at that time. In fact, it wasn't until war was declared with Italy that we got anything. We had one Rapide, which was in the division, and it used to come flapping over and trying to get a little information, but that was only about once every 6 months that they could afford to let it go. And our information was very scarce, added to which we got very little information about the European war, merely because the division was growing so fast, they just didn't have time. Nor, in those days, had they got the wonderful organisation of news sheets from Europe, from Middle East, from everywhere, which eventually came through. But our intelligence was terribly limited. It was limited to ourselves, which was a pity, because one of the greatest principles is to be able to tell your troops as much information as possible.
Did you ever gain anything useful from the forward patrols, from their reports?
Not until the war was declared. No.
And what then?
Well, then, of course, we began to find out where the Italians were basing themselves and moving, and they were sending out patrols. And in the very beginning of the Abyssinian campaign, when we withdrew from Moyale and the 5th Battalion was a place called Buna, there was the most magnificent little man, an Italian officer, whose name I forget, but we called him Twinkle Toes because he had such tiny little boots. And he was always a menace. He produced his little patrol and he'd come and fire at you through your wire and your outposts and then push off. And we never knew where he was and we never caught him. We tried many times, but he was too clever for us. But he was, I gather from the people who met him afterwards, when the Abyssinian campaign was over. He was a very charming and nice soldier.
Did he ever do any damage on these?
Oh, he wounded the odd man, but no. not from his patrols. They didn't wait very long. They would fire a few rounds into your camp and get you all in positions and we would blaze off, but he then disappeared.
He was just waking you up.
He was just waking us up and keeping us on our toes.
What about contacts with local civilians in that area? Did you get any useful information out of them?
Oh, yes. The Somalis who lived there were a great source of information, and they would always tell us. But it was such a vast country that it was terribly difficult. You see, they virtually were confined to either their Kenya home or the Somali home. Well, the Somali land in those days was under Abyssinia, and they didn't cross the border too easily.
How was the withdrawal from Moyale accomplished then, when you were concentrating further east?
Well, it was a company of the 1st KR under Captain Henderson was in Moyale, and we were sent up to form a base through which they would withdraw. And unfortunately, once again, the wireless broke down. And we were all in position all night waiting for them to come back, but nothing happened because they hadn't received the information. However, we got the information through the next day, and the following night they withdrew. There was one badly wounded Askari who they left with a note because they couldn't move him. He was too ill. So they left him with a note. And the Italians who came over within half an hour, I believe, of the last of our troops leaving, they took him away and looked after him and sent him back to Kenya, and they were marvellous. But we then withdrew. They moved back through us. And as the following day, we then withdrew. Now, just on the southern side of the border, below Moyale, which was on the top of a precipice, was an airstrip. And we left the airstrip in the morning following the withdrawal and went back to this place called Buna. It was on this march back that we suddenly heard what most people thought was a swarm of bees, but it was a Caproni aircraft, an Italian Caproni aircraft. And they came down the road and shot us up with their machine guns and dropped bombs, but nobody was hurt. It was quite incredible. But there's one little incident. At that time, we had Lord Mornington in command of B Company, and he was, of course, the Duke of Wellington's regiment and the Duke of Wellington's heir. And he was standing in the middle of the road, firing his revolver at this Caproni.
Was the Italian Air Force very active in this early stage?
Not really. They've only got a couple of machines, as we had. But it's from the Moyale incident onwards that they did send over their Capronis much more frequently. And they began to cause us a little trouble. We had to dig trenches and we used to get in and have these alarms. But there was practically no damage done by them. And they didn't come more than once a week.
Did the Italians attempt to interfere with the withdrawal from Moyale?
No, they didn't know anything about it. They were fast asleep 100 yards away, and our people just crept out. And of course the Askari, without any boots, they never wore their boots when they were fighting. They just took their boots off. They didn't like them slung around their necks, and you couldn't hear them.
How had this soldier who was badly injured been injured then? Had he been in a patrol clash or something?
Yes,
like
well,
that?
They kept firing at each other and lobbing mortars over. They had a two. We gave Moyalia two-inch mortars, and the Italians lobbed mortars over at us and this sort of thing. And he'd been wounded in the encampment.
And you said the two patrol bases were in sight of each other.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Do you know why it was decided that we should withdraw from Moyale?
Well, it was an impossible position. The Italians were building up a large force behind Moyale, and we had one battalion with brigade headquarters about 100 miles back. And it was... we could not... The nature of the terrain of the country, it would have been foolish to leave troops up there. We had to withdraw our line to a more easily defended position.
It sounds as though then brigade had some idea of what was happening on the other side of the border.
Oh, yes. It was... their intelligence by this time was getting quite good. And they realised that the Italians were building up in this area.
Did you get a lot of summaries coming down to you at battalion level from brigade?
Yes. Oh, yes, they told us everything they knew. But, you see, it wasn't terribly frequent because we got one company and you could only do limited patrolling in that area. And once the war started, it wasn't so easy to send a lorry out with a section to patrol because it had to be defended. So you had to send two lorries and you had to send more chaps to defend the lorries while the patrol was out. And we hadn't got the transport.
What happened to you then after you'd formed up at Buna? Did you stay there?
We stayed there for a few months. And then gradually, by this time, you see, the East African Division was beginning to form very quickly. And we lived at Buna entirely doing patrols, trying to catch twinkle toes, but we never did. And
did you catch anybody else?
Well, we went off to a place called El Wak, and we did a long night march through El Wak, but this was not only... it was the 6th Battalion. John McNabb, who was a company commander in those days, was in command of the force. I went as his staff officer, and we had, I think, one company of ours and one company of theirs, and we were supported by the Recce Regiment, who were these people, a newly formed little Recce Regiment, who had these armoured lorries that had been made by the railway. They were little trucks, actually. They weren't big lorries, they were little trucks. And they didn't even mount